Last Scene, a new podcast from WBUR and the Boston Globe, investigates the largest unsolved art heist in history, the theft of $500 million worth of art from the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. Last Scene debuts Monday. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts.
This message comes from On Point sponsor Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield approval. If you qualify and if rates go up, your rate stays the same. But if rates go down, your rate also drops. To learn more, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. For more than 30 years running, football has been the most popular professional sport in the country. It's not even close. This year has just started, and fans have already witnessed some stunning moments.
Rodgers, serving, fires, that's caught. Randall Cobb into Chicago territory. Randall Cobb inside the 20-yard line. Randall Cobb is going to score!
Rodgers, of course. Aaron Rodgers, the star quarterback of the Green Bay Packers. That touchdown capped a storybook comeback from the Packers last Sunday against the Chicago Bears. Rodgers had just sustained a knee injury in the first half. Commentators praised his grit. That's what the league wants you to talk about. But such exciting plays aren't the only headlines the NFL inspires. Player protests during the national anthem and the president's denunciations. The taxpayer subsidies for the league's billionaire owners. Declining ratings. Player violence. And the debilitating toll of the game on the men who play it. The league wants to duck these controversies like Cam Newton scrambling in the pocket. We won't. This hour on Point, the NFL in dangerous times. You can join us on air or online. Are you an NFL diehard? What keeps you coming back? What do you make of the protests and the injuries and everything else? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org, on the Twitter and the Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Dallas, Texas is Clarence Hill Jr. He is the Dallas Cowboys reporter for the Star-Telegram and covers the NFL. Clarence, welcome to On Point.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Yes, sir. So tell me, like, on the field, what are the things we should look for this season? What are the exciting stories?
I mean, the exciting story number one is up in Seattle, where you got Shaquem Griffin, who's playing with one arm. The great inspiring story, playing with one arm, came out of Central Florida last year. He's actually playing with his twin brother. That is one of the most heartwarming stories of the league. You got that. And also whether the Eagles are going to repeat. You know, the Eagles, Carson Wentz is still out. They still have Nick Foles, the backup quarterback, who had a great Cinderella story last year. Can they repeat? Those are two of the top stories. Then you have John Gruden coming back in Oakland, you know.
Long time coach and then later commentator.
Coming out the booth and thinking this is the 90s or early 2000s all over again, and he gets rid of his best player. Who does that?
Why did he do that, by the way?
I don't know. It's typical John Gruden because he wants to, in my opinion, basically smear everything that happened before him so he can tear it down and build it back up. And when they do win, if they do win, it's all about what he did and not the players that were there before.
You know, the team that obviously you get to see up close and know best in some ways, it's got to be the Dallas Cowboys themselves. And Jerry Jones, one of the most colorful figures in Dallas. They've been one of the most successful franchises over the history of the NFL. How are they looking this year?
You know what? They lost their first game to the Carolina Panthers, 16-8. This is a team that saw Jason Witten retire, and Dez Bryant, they released him, and they revamped the offense, and they go out and score 8 points in the season opener, and it's fire all around in Dallas, Texas, and everybody's upset and frustrated and worried, and you know, this is a year that's a crucial year for Coach Jason Garrett. You know, he's firmly on the hot seat. If he doesn't win and doesn't get things done after being here 7.5 years, they can make a move. Dak Prescott, a quarterback who retired Tony Romo 2 years ago with a great rookie year, probably the best rookie season of any quarterback in NFL history, is now being questioned whether that's, you know, some type of fake play or fake show from him, and they're questioning everything about him. And, you know, so those are the things that are right now in Dallas. That's a big deal going into Sunday night against the New York Giants. And then, of course, you know, Jerry Jones, he's front and center with the anthem and the flag controversies and the Nike stuff, and he's, you know, been subpoenaed with the Kaepernick collusion case.
Well, so to unpack that just briefly, I mean, this is, you know, a guy like you in years past might have really focused almost exclusively on what happened on the field. But a job like yours now encompasses so much more. So you're talking about the protest, and we'll talk about that a little bit more down the line as well. But we'll talk about the protest involving former NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick, the question of taking a knee during the national anthem. And some players are still doing that this season in protest, not of the anthem, but of the of law enforcement officials. And violence towards African Americans, and there's been a strong backlash on that. How big a story is that going to be this year?
You know what? The interesting thing is that not many players are protesting. You know, not as in past years. And I think it was only a handful, if that many, during the first week of the season. Some are still protesting. The NFL has basically backed off their new rule of banning players or disciplining players who attempted to protest. And I think people are waking up. There's a difference between, and what people don't understand, there's a difference between charity and social justice. You know, and people want to trump players giving to charity. That's one thing. But social justice is a whole nother commitment, whole nother level. And so that's what, you know, I think the message was mixed or misunderstood by owners and you know, people in the country who are taking a backlash on these players, and you know, thinking that, well, you can give a charity, but you shouldn't
express yourself on in this way.
It's a whole different deal, and you should be able to fight for your social justice. That's certainly a whole other commitment. And again, everybody is not built for that. Mm-hmm. You know, Dak Prescott, quarterback for the Cowboys, you know, got a lot of backlash in the during training camp because he, you know, basically said, "I want to stand for the anthem. I want to do it in a different way."
Sure.
You know, and so everybody's not built to be Colin Kaepernick. Everybody's not built to be Malcolm Jenkins in Philadelphia.
Well, and not everybody may be built to be Clarence Hill Jr., the Dallas Cowboys reporter for the Star-Telegram. We're glad that you are. We appreciate your joining us today. Thank you so much, Clarence.
No problem. Thank you.
Joining now from NPR West in Culver City, California, is Mark Leibovich. He's the New York Times Magazine's chief national correspondent. He has waded into football, although it seems as though it was a personal passion pretty much for a full lifetime. His new book is entitled Big Game, The NFL in Dangerous Times. You can find an excerpt of his book on our website, onpointradio.org. Mark, welcome to On Point.
Good to be with you, David.
So before we get into talking about the protests, which we will do a bit later in the show, I want to talk to broaden it out and talk a little bit about the people who have been setting some of the policies we've just heard from Clarence Hill that were enacted by the league. You know, you looked at the league. You spent a lot of time with Tom Brady and other players. You went to talk with fans occasionally, had meals and drinks with them, occasionally had drinks with other people we can talk about. But you focused a lot about on the league leadership and the league owners. What fascinates you about them? Why are they worth scrutinizing?
Well, first of all, to me, going into this project, I really had no idea the degree to which an underappreciated story the 32 people who own NFL teams are. I mean, these are all entertainment magnates in that to own a football team in a market in the United States is to have an incredible amount of power over not just the economy of your local team, but also just sort of the culture and the mood of your communities. And just getting to know what they call the membership. This is what NFL owners call themselves. It's probably the most exclusive billionaire boys club we have in America. Donald Trump has been trying to get into it for four decades, and he had to settle for a consolation prize at the White House.
Right.
And now he can heckle from the bully pulpit. But I came to this as a football fan. I remain a football fan. And I also sort of came into this to try to escape from politics, and there was no escape from politics. But I also was fascinated by the kind of bonfire of the vanities at the top of the league and just the people who run it and people who own it.
Mark, at one point, clearly throughout the book, which is filled with hilarious anecdotes and your own, less than reverent observations about the people who populate the league and its leadership, you wander through. These guys are at times buffoonish. They're vain. They're incredibly wealthy. But you underscore, they're no smarter or better looking or wiser or more self-controlled than the rest of us, and often much less so because of their finances. And yet you write, there's an honesty about football that politics could never match. How is that possible?
Well, there's an honesty to playing football on the field. I mean, the great thing about football that, again, unlike politics, you can't spin a loss. You can't, try to say, hey, those numbers on a scoreboard, they're fake news. I mean, look, there is a clean result at the end of a day's work at a football game. Also, you know, if you went to Harvard or Alabama, but you don't play football as well as the guy who went to the University of whatever next to you, they're just going to perform. And you can't, you can be exposed very, very easily on a football field. So I appreciate the honesty of sports.
All right, but in the skyboxes, you're depicting a very different reality. The guys that we see partying with, you know, John Bon Jovi or Chris Christie or whoever other celebrity that Fox or CBS shows, right? Those guys.
It is bizarre. Yeah. No, these are, look, I was highly unimpressed with most of the owners. Some of them are a lot of fun. The aforementioned Jerry Jones, you know, he's fun to hang out with. You know, people like Robert Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, which is the team I root for, and I hope, having admitted that, people will still consider reading the book because I know that we have some baggage. I've been dealing with this for forever. But no, these are, by and large, these are not the people you would pick to make the all-star, you know, corporate board if you were running Apple or Federal Express or Bank of America. Nor would Roger Goodell be the CEO you pick to run a major entertainment company like this. A lot of them just sort of lucked into this, and it's a form of American royalty and entitlement that I don't think we even begin to understand, and I certainly didn't before I jumped into this.
It makes it clear that, you know, you talk about Roger Goodell and he talks about the integrity of the game. And he talked, you know, the image tattered on your cover, nonetheless, is that very well-known picture of the field with the stars, you know, the football against the field of stars there, the NFL in red. And he talks about the integrity of the game. And yet it does not emerge from your book that the integrity of the game is first, second or seventh on their list of priorities.
No, money is first, second, and seventh on the list of priorities. I mean, Roger Goodell has one really important – actually, two really important jobs, and that is to make 32 billionaires more billions of dollars every year than he does, than they do. And he does. He's great at just printing money for a monopoly organization that has an absolute stranglehold on the American entertainment just sort of, you know, just mind. I mean, the football games – I mean, for all the talk and all the off-field distractions, 1 week ago, the top five top-rated shows over last weekend were all football games, Thursday to Sunday, or Thursday to Monday, despite, you know, all the talk about the gloom and doom and Colin Kaepernick and so forth. 77 of the top 100 top-rated TV shows in 2017 were all football games. And, you know, there were record ratings the first weekend of the season. So for as imperfect as the people who run this game are, you know, the game itself persists and is as strong as ever.
Well, Goodell, you describe him as presenting himself as the righteous arbiter of all things precious in pro football. We're talking about all things precious and not so precious in pro football with Mark Leibovich of the New York Times. Mark, stick around. You can join the conversation. Did you ever stop watching football after learning about players' brain injuries? Or do you ignore the clashes and simply love the game? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
This message comes from On Point sponsor Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing their all-new Rate Shield approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Quicken Loans will lock your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're looking at the successes and anxieties plaguing the NFL today and the personalities who help drive it on and off the field. You can join the conversation. What does football mean to you? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Few people outside the league have gotten to know these personalities better than Mark Leibovich, the author of the new book, Big Game, The NFL in Dangerous Times. We do have a caller for you, Mark. Jackie is calling from Cleveland, Ohio. It sounds like you're a close watcher of the game and the league. What are your thoughts today?
Hi, David. My thought is, or my question is, simple. I just want to know why or how the NFL or the league can be deemed a nonprofit. organization. I don't get that. If someone could explain that to me, I'd appreciate it.
Mark Leibovich, what do you think?
Well, that's an antiquated and sort of antithetical and always puzzling notion because they, as we mentioned before, they just print money, make all kinds of profits. They did have that designation, sort of as this quirk of regulation, and that, you know, unfortunately, that changed a few years ago. And as a result of them giving up their nonprofit status, they no longer have to reveal the salaries of their top executives, namely Roger Goodell. But because these things get out, we know that Roger Goodell just last year signed a new 5-year contract extension that could be worth over $200 million starting next year.
Mark, talk a little bit about the role Goodell plays because, you know, he's the face of the NFL. In reality, the owners are not his wards, they're his bosses. And yet, you know, he's the guy who says, I'm the sheriff here. I'm going to set the tone for what owners can and can't do. I'm going to be the one who decides on Deflategate for your loved Patriots. I'm going to be the travesty of a sham, of two shams of a farce. He's also the guy who's, meets out suspensions for players accused of, severe at times misconduct, violence against domestic partners at times. Is he actually upholding any notion of principle here? Is he simply, as a politician's son, playing a political game?
Well, I think I would certainly say he's playing a political game. I mean, he has this weird dynamic where he's essentially the head of a trade association of, again, 32 very, very powerful members. And he serves absolutely at the pleasure of these 32 owners who employ him. So his job is essentially to keep them happy. But part of his job is also to discipline them, to take away their draft picks, to fine them, to absolutely smear their reputations if he deems it fit. And it is a totally strange dynamic. I mean, I asked him about this. He said, it's not every job where you can discipline your boss. And that is an undeniably true statement. I'd never heard that before. So Roger Goodell is essentially, but the political part of his job is keeping 32 people, very needy, largely old, almost entirely white men, happy. And he's very good at that, that aspect of his job. Steve Tisch, the co-owner of the New York Giants, referred to the NFL ownership group, the membership, as they call them. He referred to them as junior high school for billionaires. and that's basically true. I mean, they get to enact their, their sort of athletic fantasies through these gladiators who they employ. And Roger Goodell essentially is employed by the owners, but he also, he has to, be the sheriff. I mean, there's a lot going on with his job, and he's obviously very good at making these people money. He's also not a terribly effective spokesman for the game in the last few years, as evidenced by the incredible loathing that many, many fans and players reserve for him.
In the course of reading this book, you really get to feel for some of the key players among the owners. You get a feel for the pettiness at times that drives these guys, as well as the quest for profits. The ego is involved. I mean, they've got to have ego involved to invest so much time and effort in football teams, although it turns out to be a pretty lucrative investment. I think you said that, when Jerry Richardson, who is the controlling owner of the Panthers in Carolina, had to sell off his team, I think it was like a tenfold increase. And that was forced because of accusations of sexual harassment. It wasn't because he wanted to cash out.
No, he sold the team in utter disgrace last year, and he sold the Carolina Panthers, which he started. Basically, he paid something like $170 million for the right to start the Carolina Panthers. He sold the team for $2.25 billion last January. And I guess disgraced ownership pays pretty well.
There were a couple of vignettes you had in there. You had, I think it was, I could be getting this wrong, but I think it was Arthur Blank, who was the owner of the Falcons, who took aside Bob Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, after Kraft had fashioned a particular Super Bowl ring. What was happening there?
Yes. Now, this absolutely underscores your point about the pettiness. Robert Kraft, the owner of my New England Patriots.
By the way, you're not making him look good in this. Let's be clear.
I know. No, I'm brutally honest. I know exactly all the crosses we have to bear. And I remain a Tom Brady fanboy, but I don't think Robert Kraft liked the book. I don't think Bill Belichick. Actually, I don't think he read the book, but I don't think he would like the book either. And look, my eyes are wide open. But Arthur Blank was upset with Robert Kraft. These are the two teams that played in the Super Bowl 51. And it was a fairly memorable game. The Patriots were down 28-3 late in the third quarter. They came back and they won in overtime. And if that wasn't humiliating enough to a humiliation enough to visit upon Arthur Blank, Robert Kraft went and ensured that the Super Bowl rings that he had commissioned for his team had exactly 283 little diamonds embedded into like the massive sort of garish fist ornament that is the ring, just to underscore that they came back from a 28-3 deficit. And this, of course, got out in the press. And Arthur Blank, told Robert that he was extremely ticked off about this. Actually, he told Robert this, and then he told me this. I dutifully reported it. And then Arthur caught all this backlash because it said, hey, well, you know, if you don't want to be humiliated in a Super Bowl ring, blame your coaches. So it was pettiness all around.
Blank comes off as actually one of the grown-ups of the league by and large in this. And yet, you know, even in by raising the issue, it's clear it rankled him. You had this other square off between, Jerry Jones, aforementioned owner of the Dallas Cowboys, and Kraft. And you kind of basically stoked a little resentment, I think, by asking each one, well, you know, Bob Kraft, you've won more Super Bowls. Would you trade it to be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio yourself? And you said to Jerry Jones the same thing. Would you trade your golden jacket of being in the Hall of Fame in order to have won more Super Bowls than Bob?
Okay, so now if you're an NFL owner, there is absolutely one answer you can give to this. Whether it's honest or not, the one answer is I would do nothing. I would do anything for another Super Bowl ring. There is nothing more important to me or our fans as winning another Super Bowl. So I asked Mr. Kraft, and they all must be called Mr. That's one of the first things you learn when you walk through the doors of the NFL. You must always address the owners as Mr., Mr., Mr. I said, Mr. Kraft, would you trade the ring for one of your five rings for Jerry's Super Bowl Hall of Fame jacket? And he said, absolutely not. So that's the correct answer. I then asked Mr. Jones in Dallas the same question. And granted, we'd had a bit of scotch at that point. He had offered me a shot of scotch, which by shot he meant a 24-ounce sort of
everything's big gulp in Dallas.
Everything's big gulp in Dallas. And so pretty far into our interview, he said he just hemmed and hawed and finally said, no, I'm going to keep my Super Bowl or my Hall of Fame jacket. And this, of course, is the absolute politically incorrect thing to say. And I think he caught some heat in
Basically,
Dallas.
I care more about me than the team you pay a lot of money to buy the jerseys of.
Which is honest, which is, I guess, totally honest. And probably the, you know, I would say that probably would probably, if given truth serum or more scotch, the rest of the league would probably, you know, have a similar breakdown. But look, it was, I think he had to walk it back. I think it caused some small issues for him in Dallas.
I want to offer one observation from a listener who astutely points out, which you know well, the aforementioned Green Bay Packers, the one team of the 32 not owned by a billionaire, owned by essentially the community itself and its fans. As our listener Kenneth says, that's one of the reasons Packers fans love their team. And he didn't even have to say, and hate your Patriots, Mark Leibovich.
Everybody hates our Patriots.
I want to go in just a moment to talk a little bit about the protests. Our lines are burning up. But I do think it's worth, before we walk away from thinking about the owners, that, you know, a lot of the owners that look at places like Dallas and the Patriots look at them with some envy, and they skip around in hopes of finding better fortunes and establishing greater profits. You're seeing two teams moving to Los Angeles, the Oakland Raiders leaving Oakland once more for Las Vegas, a city that, you know, for decades the NFL scorned because of legalized gambling there. What relationship are fans supposed to have for their teams? Or are they rooting, as Jerry Seinfeld once said, for the laundry?
For laundry, right. Well, here's the thing. I mean, the NFL, I mean, put aside, and it's hard to put aside, but let's put aside for a second the quote-unquote existential issues of concussions or just sort of the demographic changes or the technological cultural changes that are going to be big challenges for the league going forward. I mean, just the mere fact that they have alienated just market upon market of fans and former fans to a point where Roger Goodell, I mean, he should never set foot in Oakland. He should never set foot in San Diego. He should never set foot in St. Louis. I mean, those are just franchise relocations. You know, he certainly would have a hard time going to Foxborough without added security because of Deflategate, Dallas, Baltimore because of Jerry Rice. I mean, he has alienated large
groups of
people. Ray Rice. Large groups of people all over the country, fans. And look, it's terrible to lose your team. I don't think, I mean, the people of Los Angeles seem seemed totally fine without a football team for 20-plus years, and now they have two, and I still to this day have never met a Los Angeles Chargers fan. I've met many San Diego Chargers fans, but I don't know if they exist anymore because their team went and spurned them for a fat stadium deal in Los Angeles. So, look, it is a real issue, and I think it does underscore the idea that it's just about making more money for the owners.
So let's talk a little bit about the protest and about a player who says he's doing things because not because he's thinking about profit, but because of principles that he holds dear. Colin Kaepernick started off a wave of protests quietly, actually. He was, I think, then a quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers. And he initially sat for the national anthem during preseason games back 2 years ago in 2016. Here's what he told reporters.
The message is that we have a lot of issues in this country that we need to deal with. We have a lot of people that are oppressed. We have a lot of people that aren't treated equally, aren't given equal opportunities.
And Kaepernick later started kneeling, which is what people now think of him doing, during the anthem rather than sitting. He had sought the advice of the former Navy SEAL and New England Patriot fullback Nate Boyer, who recommended kneeling and saying that that would be a sign of respect. Not everybody took it that way. President Trump had some strong words about the protest that Kaepernick inspired. Trump was speaking in September of last year during a rally in Huntsville, Alabama.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a off the field right now, out, he's fired.
President of the United States speaking about an NFL QB as an SOB. And now we have Steve calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm doing better now. I'm talking to you. Tell me what you think about all this.
Well, I think it's important to note that Mr. Trump has an axe to grind with the NFL because 35, 40 years ago, they wouldn't let him own a team. And he was involved in the upstart United States Football League, where he owned the New Jersey Generals. And as a threat alternative to the NFL, and Mr. Trump overpaid for talent, overpaid the market rate in his frenzied quest to build the greatest, as he always needs to do, build the biggest, greatest, best. And basically drove the implosion of that league. Had they been able to build and sustain, they might have been a threat to the NFL.
Right.
But you know, he had it and basically dropped the ball and messed it up.
So, Steve, I think you raise a really interesting point. Trump often acts out of pique and out of personal history. Mark Leibovich, how much do you think Trump's expressions of anger about these protests and about players at the NFL, mocking them for ratings dips here and there, has to do with his own inability to get into the league itself? You've actually interviewed the president.
Yeah, no. I mean, he's got a lot of history with the NFL. I mean, not just the USFL history, but he's tried over four decades to actually purchase NFL teams. Most recently in 2014, he tried to buy the Buffalo Bills. He failed. I mean, the owners of the league, you know, for a number of reasons, wanted nothing to do with him. And, so he could own the Buffalo Bills now, and the NFL wouldn't have any problem for the White House, most likely. But, no, there's obviously a whole bunch of personal grievances tied up in this. But he also thinks this is a winning political issue for him. He thinks that the majority of Americans, you know, believes the players should stand for the national anthem. And, you know, it certainly plays well with his base. And I think we're going to be hearing that repeatedly from him as we move closer to the midterm elections.
So we have a call from Omaha, Nebraska. Simone, I believe it is. You're on the air.
Hi, David.
Hi, Simone. Welcome to On Point. What are your thoughts on all this?
I have two thoughts. One is that I think that the Colin Kaepernick controversy contributes largely to a silencing of minority, namely black athletes in America. I feel like Colin Kaepernick is exercising his right as an American to use his platform to express ideas that fit his beliefs. I think it's similar to the shut up and dribble type attitude that people have towards black athletes in general. Mm-hmm. And my second comment is that I'm a black mother to a black son, and I don't plan on allowing him to play football. I think that the physical repercussions of it are very, very, very obvious. And I wanted to ask him a question from a professional standpoint because I don't know all that much about football. It seems like there's a positional disparity between whites and blacks, or minority players and white players. It seems like quarterbacks and other positions are predominantly white, while linebackers and other positions that absorb the most impact during the game are black. Is this something that is kind of institutional in football?
Mark? It has been for a long time, yes. I mean, traditionally, the quarterback position, which is the most, you know, sort of certainly the, always the best paid position, has gone to white players. It's only until probably the last few decades that there have been, you know, a pretty critical mass of very, you know, starting African-American quarterbacks. So, yeah, I mean, that's a very, very, I mean, there's a disparity there, much less so than there used to be.
Sure.
Same with coaches, same with front office. So, that's been true.
You've seen a lot of people addressing that, and yet it hasn't utterly been reversed. Mark Leibovich, author of Big Game about the NFL, we're doing a deep dive into the world of professional football. We want you to stick around. We want you, our listeners, to stick around, and we want you to continue to join our conversation. If you were on the field, would you take a knee, trade in your Nikes? You're hearing Carrie Underwood's controversial new theme song for NBC's Sunday Night Football show, Game On. Me, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Planet Money tip number 17. Sometimes the most important things need a hype squad.
Corporate. Income.
Income.
Tax.
Corporate income tax!
Planet Money, a podcast about the economy. A very enthusiastic podcast about the economy.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're looking at the angst and aspirations of the NFL today. You can join our conversation. What does football mean to you? I'm speaking with Mark Leibovich. He's the author of the new book, Big Game, The NFL in Dangerous Times. I'd like to bring in another voice into our conversation. Joining us now from Columbus, Ohio, is Joshua Perry. He's a former NFL linebacker who retired from the NFL in July at the age of 24 after suffering his sixth documented concussion. Now founder and CEO of the Joshua Perry Family Foundation, a youth empowerment nonprofit. Joshua, welcome to On Point.
Hi, David.
So you retired, and we've heard of players doing that. You're retiring at the age of 24. That's relatively early in a professional football career, at least as we think of your age, even if the average career doesn't last super long. Explain to us your decision, what was behind it.
Yeah, I think when you look at a football career, you've got to factor in all the elements, right? So obviously the notoriety and the money is great, but the health aspect is probably the major negative, the major downfall of playing professional football. And so for me, I always knew the calculated risk. I always understood that I would rather honestly sustain a torn ACL, torn Achilles, a broken arm, than a concussion. And so after having six concussions throughout my playing career that were documented, and they started off in high school, who knows what I might have sustained in middle school or little league, it was time for me to kind of pack it in.
I want to take a couple, you know, we've got a lot of people calling on this issue. I want to take a couple of calls and then bounce it off you. First, I'd like to take a call from Gloucester, Massachusetts. Bob, you're on the air. Go ahead, sir.
Yes. Hi, David. Hi, Mark. Thank you both. I want to address the choreographed battle aspect of football. And I want to tie this back, comparison, contrast, to the Coliseum. I'm not going to get into religion and all that and the victims.
But you're talking about the Colosseum in Rome, back in ancient Rome.
In Rome, if I didn't say that correctly, yes, in Rome is what I'm referring to. But I think that people have a certain innate bloodlust. I'm not suggesting people want to see people get hurt. I like watching racing, not crashing. But I think that that is what I'm getting to is the popularity of the sport. And it is a choreographed battle, which has been compared to ballet in the past for the athletic moves.
But you see it as having kind of a gladiator's approach, it sounds like, and that people are interested in that. Thank you so much for that. Thank you so much for that, Bob. We've also got a call from Boston, not so far away. Eric, you're on the air. Tell us what the NFL represents to you.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. Real quick, my opinion is kind of the opposite of what I've been hearing a lot of. So I played football my entire life, played up in the college, sustained several concussions, broken legs, the whole nine yards. But, I feel like it's a certain kind of person that's built to play football. You know those risks going into it. And what has turned me off to the NFL is I think they've really been overcompensating since all this concussion information came out. Mm-hmm. And, you see plays called for unnecessary roughness where it's, a lot of these guys are covering 10 yards a second with their 40 times. You can't, with a receiver that flinches, if your head ends up hitting a certain way, you can't control that. And just all the flags that are getting thrown, it's completely turned me off the NFL. And I watch college football now because it's a pure form of the game.
All right. Well, thank you, Eric, for that. Eric feels that the purity of the game has been affected. I think, in some ways I want to refer to something that's called in shorthand CTE. That's chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Excuse me. It's a disease that progresses. Patients experience problems with thinking and memory, memory loss, confusion, impaired judgment, eventually progressive dementia. Some common changes witnessed in those folks, according to the Concussion Legacy Foundation website, includes impulse control problems, aggression, depression, and paranoia. And one other disturbing nugget of information, Dr. Ann McKee of Boston University found, according to the New York Times, that 110 of 111 brains from deceased NFL players that she studied showed varying signs of CTE. Josh Perry, you retired at the age of 24, as you mentioned, over the question of concussions experienced over the course of your football playing days. How confident are you in the steps that the NFL has taken in order to address this health issue?
Yeah, I think it's a big balance. So I think the research that they're doing is great. And obviously they've devoted a lot of money to former players as well to deal with some of the concussion issues that people might be experiencing, the neurocognitive issues. To me, I think the steps that they've taken on the field might be a little bit drastic because I think Eric was the caller who said it, but it is a calculated risk. You got to know what you're going into and understand that. That's why I drew the line where I drew the line. Some guys aren't willing to do that. They put their body on the line for the money, for whatever it is, to be able to play the game that they love, to be able to continue that journey, and that's a risk that they understand, especially now with a lot of the research that they have. I just wish that some of the research was clearer. You look at that study where they had the 110 brains out of 111 showed some signs of CTE, and you could say that there's some selection bias there. But you can also say that maybe that football doesn't cause concussions, but those impacts obviously do. Impacts from car crashes cause them too. But is there a way that we can craft our equipment? Is there a way that we can craft our training so that we can take away some of these impacts? Not necessarily at game time, but more so, are there preventative measures we can take?
Mark Leibovich, drastic? Is that how would you characterize the steps the NFL has taken?
Well, I will say this. I mean, I think the gentleman's name was Dan, but the one from Boston. I mean, mm-hmm. His view on the overcompensation of just rules and just trying to, just too many penalty flags and too many new, rule changes and so forth, is not an uncommon view among people who watch or have played football. I mean, in fact, Donald Trump, before he went after Colin Kaepernick, he actually complained during the 2016 campaign that football had gone soft. There are too many penalty flags. And it was sort of a metaphor for his political correctness gone amok, sort of taken onto the football field. And he said that football has gone soft and America has gone soft. So he drew a parable there. But it is not an uncommon view. And I also think that, look, the league, I think that the buyer beware piece of this is not a small thing either. I think right now the information is available. The research is becoming pretty conclusive. And yes, the league is devoting, you know, resources to more research, to new equipment, to studying things. But ultimately, the game is not going to be safe. And I think people, you know, I think more information is better. The question is, what will people do with the information? And I think in the case of Joshua, you know, some players who know what they're getting into are just going to make a decision at a certain point that this is not worth it to me.
You know, the model Gisele Bündchen, who's the wife of New England Patriot Tom Brady, had some strong thoughts about this. She's obviously somebody who knows something about fame, knows something about prominent career, knows something about the importance of looks and a physique to a career. She discussed Tom Brady's long-term health in an interview last year with CBS.
I just have to say, as a wife, I'm a little bit, you know, it's, as you know, it's not the most like... let's say an aggressive sport, right? Football, like he had a concussion last year. I mean, he has concussions pretty much. I mean, we don't talk about, but he does have concussions. And he's, I don't really think it's a healthy thing for your body to go through.
She just said, we don't talk about it. Mark Leibovich, you're not only Tom Brady's biggest fanboy, but also you spent time really talking and emailing with the man. How candid is he about it?
Yeah, I am Tom Brady's utmost, most professional fanboy. But no, yeah, he's not candid at all. As his wife just said, we don't talk about it, which, you know, that remark caused a major, well, I would say, I don't know about major, but certainly took a lot of notice at the league. I mean, the league had to investigate whether he had, you know, concussions, whether they've been hiding concussions. But no, I mean, Tom Brady is 41 years old. He plays, I mean, he's been very, very lucky. There's obviously, I mean, a great interest in his career because he's so good. But it's also, when you get to be over 40, the question is, I mean, at what cost in the long term? Now, he plays a position that is relatively safe on the football field. I mean, quarterbacks, kickers, punters, they're fine china, basically. I mean, they're not linebackers, they're not offensive linemen. There are fewer collisions. But yeah, I mean, the wives, I mean, as Gisele Bündchen, you know, would attest here, I mean, this is not an easy thing to have your husband or a loved one going through. And yet, I mean, Tom Brady has made the decision that it is worth it to him, the risk is worth it to him, and he's going to keep doing it.
Mark Leibovich, in your book, you have an anecdote reminding your readers of a moment at which a player for the Kansas City Chiefs, I think it was Eric Reid, basically assailed fans of his own team because they were
– Eric Winston. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
When Matt Cassell, the quarterback for the Chiefs, was knocked out, not a, at that moment, particularly beloved quarterback right, by the fans, was knocked out. They were essentially cheering it. And Winston basically goes on this heartfelt rant saying, you know, you're cheering a guy being knocked sideways into tomorrow. Josh Perry, how much do people in locker rooms, how much in weight rooms, how much do the players talk about this, about the toll that their bodies are going to take Sunday after Sunday?
We talk about it all the time, and I think it's from a standpoint of kind of guys understand that their bodies are commodities. They understand how athletes are fetishized, where people look at us almost as, you know, like the chiseled body, and you guys are, you know, superhuman in a way. We talk about not only the physical toll that we take going out on the field and how people don't understand that it really does take a toll on your body and it adds up. But we also talk about the mental aspect of it too, to be out there, you put yourself on the line, and then to feel underappreciated by management people, underappreciated by fans because you don't make this play and you don't do that. It's kind of, but again, we said it before, and I think it's been said a number of times on here. It's all, football is a choice. It's a choice to play the game. It's a calculated risk. And so as much as we may talk about it, I think guys understand exactly what's going on, and they make a choice to continue to do it.
Here's former NFL running back Thomas Jones. He was speaking back in 2013 about what a concussion really feels like.
I've had times where I've been hit immediately, and I've seen stars like in the cartoons. Where you'll see stars. I've been hit where I've seen black spots. I've been hit where I see two of you. So I see you're here and you're here. And I have to try to put you back together.
And concussions are not the only health ailment that really affects NFL players throughout the rest of their lives. And it's worth pointing out, of course, that NFL players on average, I think, have little more than a 3-year career, even as we think of the exception like Tom Brady heading into his, you know, past his second decade in the league. We have a clip of the former NFL quarterback Jim Plunkett, who opened up about his ongoing health issues after a 16-year NFL career. He was being interviewed by the San Jose Mercury News in August of 2017.
It always hurts. My knees always ache. People say I look okay, but I really do not feel very good very often. You know, it's a 24/7 battle. You know, it's just constant pain. But you learn to deal with it.
You learn to deal with it. I feel as though somehow this is not unrelated to the question of the protests and the ways in which different people approach not just Kaepernick but other players who step up. You know, I think a majority of the league, a significant majority of the league, is African American. As Mark Leibovich, as you mentioned earlier, I think 29-30 of the owners are white men, yeah. Something like that. And you as we think about this, there's a toll being taken on a league which is significantly majority African American. They are encouraged to do, as one caller I think pointed out, charity work, encouraged to be part of their communities. But when they speak up in protest, it seems as though there are criticisms that cascade down. Is there a connection between that in any way in terms of thinking about how these players are perceived?
I think it does heighten the sense of exploitation that a lot of players do feel. And look, football, more than any other sport, is you are literally sacrificing your body. I mean, when you play baseball for 10 years, you know, the long-term health effects, I mean, barring some kind of catastrophic injury, is probably going to be fairly minimal. Same with basketball. Same with, obviously, golf, tennis, sports like that. I mean, football, you're giving up a lot of your body. You are sacrificing a lot of your possibly cognitive and certainly physical well-being. I mean, the testimonials from the Jim Plunketts of the world are not uncommon. What's interesting is most people at the end of these testimonials will say, you know, it was all worth it. I would do it all again. But it also, I think, does underscore the sense of sacrifice and actually exploitation, because this is the only major sport where players usually don't have guaranteed contracts. Their careers are very, very short. They're very replaceable. The rosters are big. And look, I mean, it is a very, very, very kind of callous world in pro football. And I think things like this only kind of underscore that.
Joshua Perry, I'm going to give you the last word. If you were to be talking to fans now, in fact, you are talking to hundreds of thousands of them at this very moment. How do you want them to think about the you when you were a player and your former colleagues? How do you want them to look at you? Do you want them to think about you purely as what you do on the field, or do you want to be able to have a larger identity than that?
Man, obviously we want to have a larger identity, and part of my part of me as a football player was always using my platform to speak out on topics that I thought were important, whether it was race relations, whether it had to do with charitable giving, anything that I thought to be important. And so a lot of times it's hard. As a basketball player or a baseball player, I think those guys get taken a little bit more seriously.
Uh-huh.
They're more respected because it's not such a brutal sport. Those guys, you see their faces, we're behind helmets.
And yet you guys very much are thinking about the world around you and the game around you as well. That's Joshua Perry, former NFL linebacker. Joshua, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Mark Leibovich is the New York Times Magazine's chief national correspondent. He's author of the big new splashy book, of course he is, Big Game, the NFL in Dangerous Times. Mark, thanks so much for joining.
Thanks, David.
And I want to offer you a programming note involving an enduring mystery that made headlines worldwide, as explored by our colleagues at WBUR and the Boston Globe. The new podcast, Last Scene, investigates the largest unsolved art heist in history, the theft of 13 pieces, that's $500 million worth of art, from the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum here in Boston, pieces by Rembrandt, Degas, Vermeer, and others, all gone.
So I'm sitting there, and it's all quiet, and then suddenly I just hear a voice go, "Listen up," like that, and it made me jump because I didn't hear the footsteps coming up to me.
Randy says a thief had checked on him at least once during the robbery. He told Randy, quote, "Don't tell him nothing. If you're good, expect a reward in a year." And he also told Randy something else.
He said, "We know where you live. We have your driver's license. We know where you live."
So, startled by the thief's sudden presence and feeling the weight of that threat, Randy says when he heard voices coming from the direction of the guard desk many hours later, he didn't dare make a sound.
You can subscribe and listen to Last Scene starting on Monday, wherever you like to find your podcasts. I'm David Folkenflik. Every Friday you'll find me here. This is On Point.